listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. to those ancestors we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation too to those ancestors, because over time they found themselves the object of a forced exodus when they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation too to those ancestors, because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation too to them, because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation to those ancestors, because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation. Ashe, pour libation to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe, 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 oh.
What you are calling African history and Negro history are the missing pages of world history. Then he said, son, go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respectful commentary of the history of the world. But my earliest impressions of them was a people in power who intended to stay in power, and I began to wonder why they had so much and other people had so little, and why everybody I knew worked harder than they. Who made this arrangement? I studied European history and world history. Now, when I went back to Schomburg with some knowledge of background of European history, now he began to show me how to study African history. Arthur Schomburg taught me the interrelationship of African history to world history. Willison Huggins of the Old Harlem History Club taught me the political meaning of history. And from the lectures of William Leo Hansberry of Howard University, I learned the philosophical meaning of history. The most valuable lesson I've learned is that when you address a people by their right name, that name must relate to land, history, and culture. All people go back to the geography of their original origin and identify themselves, no matter where they live on the face of the earth. We have overused the word black, because black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. You can call an Italian white. That don't tell you anything about him. We are the only people who seem to have lost that all essential trait.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep, and greetings to all of you, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. And I am your host, William Rogers. We are here again this Tuesday evening with a very dynamic conversation that we will be having very shortly. We thank all of you for your patronage and for joining us here this afternoon, this evening. And we look forward to a real lively discussion. We are a call-in format, so if any of you would like to call and give us your opinion or either ask a question about our subject matter, you can do so at area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. We would love to hear from you, and we'd love to have you give your input to our discussion. Tonight, we're going to talk about the black family. Can never not talk about that. There's no such thing as talking too much about it. It's very critical. It is the foundation of our existence on the planet Earth, the black family. And so the name of our program tonight is May the Circle Be Unbroken, the transformation of the black family in America. And so that's where we'll be going. We'll be looking at some issues from history, and we'll be talking about a way that we have to examine that. And why it's important for all of us is that all of us must determine the role that we're going to play, if we're going to rebuild our community, if we're going to programmatically do things, if you're going to have any interaction with your people, it has to start with the family. And so that's what we're doing tonight. And we are going to be talking with our different panel members that we always have. You know something I really realized? I really appreciate the Black Reality Think Tank family. I wasn't here last week. I wasn't able to join because we had some technical difficulty. Couldn't get the internet to catch into our server. But I understand there was a wonderful conversation that continued even though I was not on the air, on the telephone part of it. It is still available and is still active, even though we may not connect to the server versus by the internet. So I understand there was a wonderful discussion with various of you that always are part of this discussion and our family. And so I'm real happy about things like that. And then last week also, I had sent a notice around to most of our listeners that I know how to reach out to many of you. to let you know that one of our normal guests on the Black Reality Think Tank, well, not guests, but one of our panel members that's on quite frequently and has been a consistent and sometimes co-host, Dr. Bruce Bridges, was the guest speaker on last Sunday morning. And also another Black Reality Think Tank host and person and commentary, Reverend Michael Rogers. He is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Holly Springs. Dr. Bridges was his guest speaker last Sunday for his anniversary, and many of you tuned in. I really appreciate you for doing that. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a wonderful presentation by Dr. Bridges. You can listen to it if you weren't able to join it by going to the Facebook page of the First Baptist Church of Holly Springs and look at last Sunday's message. He talked about the importance and the significance of the black church in America. And so you will surely enjoy that. Well, actually, it was a sermon. So we're going to have to start calling Dr. Bridges the Reverend Doctor because he had done a very good job with that and his presentation. So, again, that is based on the appreciation of all of you who have support the Black Reality Think Tank and have become a part of this family. It's growing, and we really thank you for doing that. We really do. Okay, we're going to get moving here. I've got a couple of things I want to do before we actually start into the discussion on the Black family. First of all, we have to do our ancestral profile. As you know, we always must praise the bridges that brought us over, says the great Fannie Lou Hamer. And so tonight I'm going to do a profile on a brother that is deep. This brother is real deep. Actually, to the point that I did some additional research on him and looked at some of the things that were said and done about him and written about him. And so what I'm going to do one week on our program, I'm going to do a discussion on him, a sort of a partial discussion on this brother that I'm getting ready to talk about now. But he's a powerful, deep brother. Excuse me. His name is Moses Dixon. Moses Dixon. Moses Dixon was born in 1824, and he transitioned in 1901. Moses Dixon, bad brother, was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, on April the 5th, 1824. At 16, he began a three-year tour of the South, which persuaded him to work for the abolition of slavery. So on August the 12th, 1846, Dixon and 12 other men gathered in St. Louis to devise a plan to end slavery in America. They formed a secret organization known as the Knights of Liberty, which planned to initiate a national insurrection against slavery. Check what I said out there. 1846 formed a secret organization known as the Knights of Liberty, which planned to initiate a national insurrection against slavery. Dixon married a young lady by the name of Mary Elizabeth Butcher Peters at Galena, Illinois, on October the 5th, 1848. They had one daughter. Her name was Mamie Augusta, and a year later, the family located permanently in St. Louis, Missouri. By 1856, according to Dixon and his followers, 47,240 members of the Knights of Liberty throughout the nation stood ready to fight for freedom. In August of that year, Dixon created a smaller secret organization called the Order of 12, which was in Galena, Illinois. And during the war, the Knights disbanded, and many of their members joined the Union Army. After 1865, Dixon turned his attention to education and economic development among the freed people. He joined the AME Church in 1866 and became an ordained minister. In 1871, Dixon became the Grand Master of the Prince Hall Masons for the state of Missouri. An early supporter of the Lincoln Institute, which was later Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. Dixon also organized an organization called the Knights and Daughters of Tabor. The Knights and Daughters of Tabor, which was an African-American self-help organization. The new organization touted African-American advancement through Christian demeanor, the getting of homes and acquiring of wealth and starting businesses, and man's responsibility to the supreme being. In 1879 and 1880, when approximately 16,000 Louisiana and Mississippi African-Americans migrated to Kansas in what was called the Exodus Movement, Reverend Dixon served as the president of the Refugee Relief Board, which provided them with aid and support. The Reverend Moses Dixon died a decade later, on November the 28th, 1901, and was buried at St. Louis, Missouri. My kind of brother. And again, his name is Moses Dixon. Now, there's a lot more that I have found out recently about this dear brother. This was just a short, brief synopsis that was posted in the website, The Black Past. But there are some additional things that I found in journals and articles about him. So we're going to talk about that 1 week. There's no way I cannot do that. And that's one of the things that we've always tried to do here, along with dealing with subject matter and, you know, the things that we want to talk about that plague our community and our nation. But we also like to, you know, keep our audience and our friends up to breast with all the kind of research that's out. I was a historian. I taught history for 30-some years, and I realize how important it is. Just like Malcolm said, Fannie Lou Hamer and others who talked about the significance of history. So one of the things that I've always tried to do is provide you with references and resources that you can take a look at stuff and go back yourself, because 2 hours, we don't have time to do a lot of historical analysis and research, but at least we can provide you resources that you want it, that you can then go back and look at. So I thought maybe that I would kind of escalate that a little bit in our program. Don't want to spend a lot of time because we want to talk about the subject matter, but just kind of talk about some things that I might have run across during the week. One of the things, I'm always looking for new books and new publications out as it relates to African people. And I found a couple that I just want to share with you real quickly. I'm not going to get into any detail. There's a new book out on one of my favorite writers of all time, the great Richard Wright, writing during the years of the Harlem Renaissance. It was actually a publication that he wrote back in the 1930s, but it was lost. A major part of it was lost, and they couldn't find it. They did find parts of it that was used, and it was published like a short story, but actually it was a novel, and the name of it was The Man Who Lived Underground. The Man Who Lived Underground. Now, I remember in undergraduate school reading this as a short story, and it kind of reminded you a little bit of Ralph Ellison's book, The Invisible Man, and where this brother retreats underground and begins to make his pilgrimage throughout to do some things and clean up some stuff that needs to be cleaned up in his community. But anyway, Richard Wright had written this piece, and I think it's pre-Invisible Man, and probably, now that I look at it, Ralph Ellison probably, you know, may have borrowed some things from that. As you know, Richard Wright was basically famous for Black Boy and Native Son. This was his work. But I think if you could get a copy of this, The Man Who Lived Underground, I think that you would add that to your favorites, if he is a favorite writer of yours. So again, that's a new book that just recently came out. It's called, it's not new, but it's new based on its introduction to the public. It's called The Man Who Lived Underground. And it's Library of America Press, and it is available at any of your bookstores. And always remember, try the African-American bookstore first before we go anywhere else and try something. Something else I ran across that I just kind of had taken for granted. I don't know how many of you, probably many of you know who it is and you can call his name. But somehow or the other in our community, we've always tried to keep up with some of the workings of the NAACP. Even though I haven't always been a staunch supporter, I have been a member over the years. But I wondered, I just thought about maybe a couple of months ago, who is the president now of the NAACP? And I haven't heard his name in I don't know when. And I know that some of the older presidents and executive directors, you always heard about them all the time, people like Ben Hooks and some of those other ones that have led the march of the NAACP's agenda. And so I was wondering, who is it? Why don't we hear about him? Why is it, with all this stuff going on in the America and these cop killings and all of this demonstration, and the name of the organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, why haven't we heard from whoever the president is? But anyway, I just decided to look. His name is Derrick Johnson. And I don't know about any of you. Unfortunately, I didn't know the brother. But he is the president and CEO. And I just wondered why. And I just thought I'd mention that shortly. The other thing I want to bring up is that was an art exhibit in New York City in the 1960s. It was called I Got My Mind on Harlem. And it was extremely controversial. Presentation. It was extremely very harmful because it was about Harlem, but there wasn't one single thing in that exhibit done by the African American. I just want to remind my audience again, if you don't mind, please mute your mics. It's very sensitive. I am hearing background noise consistently, but I'd like to be able to just remind you, just turn that down if you could. So anyway, this exhibit contained nothing by any black writer or artist. And the way I found out about it, it was based on the guy who was the curator, who was a Caucasian Jewish guy. His name was Alan Schoner. And he's the one that he was the curator of that exhibit. And it was very, very controversial. I remember it because I was in New York at the time, living. John Lindsay was the mayor, and he. Could you please mute your microphone? I really appreciate that. Could you please do that? And so he was trying to stop the exhibit because he did not want it to go through, based on the fact that it did not contain anything about black folks. And so this was in 65. Well, anyway, this curator just recently died. And that's how I was reminded of this exhibit. So even back then, the thought of having an art exhibit, and you don't even have any works in there by African-American people. And I thought about that.
Yeah.
Could you please mute your microphone? Please. So in that case, but anyway, another little thing I just want to bring up to you very quickly. I was looking at an article. There's a columnist in the Wall Street Journal, a brother. His name is Jason Riley, and he does write columns for the Wall Street Journal. And back in April, and I'm just going to mention the title, and I'm not going to say anything about it because it speaks for itself. The title of his article was Race Relations in America Are Better Than Ever. I'm not going to say anymore. I'll leave that where it is. Another new book that's out that I might just want to call your attention to has something to do with Juneteenth. There's a sister that recently wrote a book called On Juneteenth, and her name is Annette Gordon Reed, and she does a fictional depiction of life during the Juneteenth issue in Texas. She's from Texas, as a matter of fact, and kind of looks at it and talks about its influence and its impact, the fact that how it may have ushered in the Civil War as well as ushered in the Mexican-American War. So that it's really a good piece. I have read maybe about two or three chapters of it, but again, it's called On Juneteenth. Her name is Annette Gordon Reed. And then the last thing is that lately, have you noticed that there's a ton of books coming out about slavery. There's a ton of movies about slavery that's out. Some are good, some are weak, you know, but I just want to mention a few of them. There was a review of the best ones. They picked the top five books about novels about the Civil War slavery. The first one was the first place was The Good Lord Byrd was the name of the book. Was written by James McBride, and it's about John Brown. Recently, there was a movie. The movie on the television series was on John Brown and what he did. Some of it was historically online. Some of it wasn't. And then the number two book was one called Henry and Clara. Henry and Clara. And this is a fiction piece as well. It deals with a lot of what was going on in 1865 at the time of the when the war was getting ready to end and what people were doing and going through. This is really, like I said, number two. And I'm not going in details. I'm just kind of just helping. That book was written by Thomas Mallon. It's called Henry and Clara. It does depict some of the things about African Americans, but again, it's a fiction piece. And then number three is The Underground Railroad by Colin Whitehead. And Amazon has recently put that movie. It's been done again, and it's now running on Amazon. There's like 10 versions of it. I binged and watched the whole thing because I did want to see it. I would recommend. I'm not going to say anything about it or tell you. I would recommend, if you really want to get a good understanding of the film, you might want to try reading his name is Colson Whitehead, is the author. Read the book first. Now the film was done by a brother, and I must say he did a very good job of it. But you might want to read the book; you'd better understand it. And the only thing that's interesting about it is that in the book, it was a real underground railroad. It was an actual railroad that ran underground and transferred African people into freedom. So you might want to take a look at that. Number four was a book called The Killer Angels. The Killer Angels, and this was about soldiers on the battlefield during the Civil War and what were going through their heads and their thoughts. It's, again, a fiction piece. And then the fifth book was a book called Washington Black. It was about the story of a young black man named George Washington Black. And it was written by Esau, it's an African name, Edukin. And it's a story of about a young brother that's getting ready to be executed for killing a white man. And all of a sudden, a hot air balloon sweeps him up to freedom. But it's symbolic of, being wrongfully charged for something and being able to get out of it and move on your own. So anyway, those are some things that I ran across that I thought I would want to share to our audience. I know our audience is always very interested in resources, but if there's any of those that you want me to repeat again, I'd be more than happy to do so. So tonight, my brothers and sisters, we're going to talk about the black family. And what I really want to do and the way I want to approach the subject of the black family is most of the time the traditional method of studying families, has often focused on the pathological stuff, the bad stuff, what's wrong with the black families. But it has never somehow or the other looked at the strong parts of the black family. What is the strength of it? What is the possibilities of it? So I thought maybe that many of us who are working out in your community, that are doing things, that are trying to make changes, who would like to be able to be involved and to make some successes along the way, may want to look at this a little different and may want to look at it in terms of the strength of the black family. Now, there's a lot of books that have been done on the black family. Some of them have been very, very positive and strong. Dr. Andrew Billingsley has done some great work on the family. Dr. Nathan and Julia Hare, who have the Black Think Tank system, have done work. She's deceased. Dr. Hare is elderly, and he is around. I don't think he's writing anymore. But he's done some powerful work on the study of the black family. And then there are books like Herbert Gutman, who was a European historian who doesn't have a clue about what slavery is, about the black family is about. But nevertheless, he has written a book called The Black Family in Slavery. and again, a lot of it. And then we all remember that infamous study of Patrick Daniel Monaghan on the black family, where he says it's pathetic. It's run by women. It's a matriarchal system. And he talked about all of the problems of the black family. But many of our scholars and a lot of the young scholars, a lot of women scholars, have began to study the black family from its strength and where it's strong. And so a lot of those studies are basically concentrated on the traditional families rather than the non-traditional families. And by that I mean the remarried families, the blended families, the dual career families, the older couples, and the African-American family, as well as other cultural groups. So they focus more on it in that way than they have, you know, in looking at that non-traditional group. African-American families and European families are clearly distinctly different in terms of the study approach and looking at them from the study approach. Most Euro-American families are a unit in which all or most of the functions and activities of family life are carried out in isolation from the other kin. However, the African-American family unit exists within the extended family, as such functions and activities are shared by both. So the European-American families are more compatible with individualism and materialism, and the African-American families show an interdependence or communal cooperation born out of necessity of providing a living. And obviously, coming out of the transatlantic system of captivity, there are a lot of things that very clearly we see. And one of the things that, if you're looking at it from what's strong, if you're going to really study the black family, you have to look at it from its African traditional system and obviously understanding what that is. And so I want to do that for just a few minutes because it's very important for helping us to understand the way families operate today. And so if we are going to do things, I think it would be best if we looked at focusing on this traditional system of life as we attempt to try to rebuild from some of the trauma and different problems that have occurred. So one outstanding feature, then, of the African, the West African tradition, that's what it would be here in this country, was the importance of the family and the ever-present consciousness of the ties of kinship. Now, that's key, and I even remember that in my days coming up in the Carolinas in the 40s and 50s. Yeah, you know, we had mothers and fathers and grandmothers. I lived with my grandmother, mother, father. Everybody was around. But I also had people next door. The lady next door to me was kind of like a mother. She was always in my business. I'd be outside playing. She'd be standing in her window listening to me, tell my mother that I was out there cursing because I said damn or something. And so those kind of police. Could you please mute your mics again? Thank you. I appreciate it. When one speaks of the family in an African context, one is referring not to the nuclear family, meaning just the husband, the wife, and your brothers and sisters, but to the kin, the extended family, which comprises a large number of blood relatives who trace their descent from a common ancestor. And that's why we have some of the most fantastic family reunions that you could ever find. I love it when we all started picking up and doing those family reunions during the summer. That was a magnificent opportunity. That was African. That's what you were seeing. The family was held together by a sense of obligation, one to the other. Each African family values included solidarity, mutual helpfulness, interdependence, and the concern for the well-being of all of the members. So you worried about Uncle Lewis or Aunt Smith that you ain't heard from in a long time. And if you didn't hear from him in a while, you started sending out messages to try to find out, can y'all run by his house and see? I ain't heard from him in a long time. That's the love that the black family has always shown, and that comes out of Africa. Each family member was required to seek to bring honor to the group. They would speak very proudly of you when you graduated from high school or college or got rewards. That was a big issue in those days. The children had obligations to their parents. There was a respect system, and they were taught to do that. It became natural. It wasn't like you were forced to do it. It came natural. I remember getting on the bus, and I wouldn't dare be sitting down, and a woman got on the bus, and I didn't get up and offer her my seat. And I might have been tired, too, but still, it was out of that custom that we were told that this is what you need to do. And then there were the elements of strong family ties that people of African descent brought with them to the Americas. And it's documented. It's well documented. There were a lot of arguments back during the time that the Africans didn't bring any of their traits with them to the Americas. They lost all of that in the Middle Passage. That's not true. And there have been scholars that have done research, people like John Blasingame, and even the Jewish historian Melville Huckabee, wrote a book called The Myth of the Negro Past, claimed that. And even, I don't consider it a good book about black family, but Herbert Gutman, in his work, his historian named Herbert Gutman, also does say that Africans have brought a lot of their things here with them and had observed that the strength of the family in the survival of Africans in America is still present. Now, Franklin Frazier, which was a sociologist that wrote a book on several, he wrote a book on the black church. He wrote a book about black cultural society called The Black Bourgeois. He also has done a lot of work on the black family. He wrote a book called The Negro Family. And he said that the Africans didn't bring anything here. That was all lost. And very clearly, he's been proven wrong. Herbert Gutman, Herkovich, all argue that the black family did bring something with them. And that's very important to do, because there were a lot of things. They even said that we didn't bring our mutual culture here. There's no way in the world you could deny that as you look around and see things. And one of the great documentations of that was a book by John Blasingame called The Slave Community, and one by Robert Ferris Thompson called Flash of the Spirit, which is talks about the carrying over of the African trait into America during the slave the slave system. And then there have been others who have discussed the formation of West African lineages pre-slavery, in pre-slavery times. And see, all of this is critical, because if we're going to in our communities try to build institutions that will bring families together, you have to take this stuff in consideration. This has to be a part of that course of action. That has to be a part of your agenda setting, is to bring the African experience in it. That's why Juneteenth and Kwanzaa and all of these events are very important, because they are about family, particularly Kwanzaa. And we should take those seriously, because those are a time to be able to bring some of this kinship system into play, and that's really what it is. In West Africa, as in elsewhere along the Atlantic coast of Africa, sun kin were even adopted, what is sometimes called a fictitious principle of kinship. We didn't send our kids to orphanages. We didn't give them up for adoption. Later, the next door may take somebody or begin to bring on the care for a child. Children is no different than it is today. There were children born to teen mothers who couldn't take care of them, a child, but they couldn't take care of themselves. How do I know? I was born to one. I was born to a 16-year-old mother. And everybody yanked me up, grandmother, aunt, grandfather, everybody just snatched me up, to the point that as I was being raised, I didn't know who was what. It didn't matter. You know, it was just everybody. I called everybody mama and daddy. But that's the system, and they treated me like that. I didn't really know the difference. They never threw it in my face until one day my mother came to visit me. And she said, "I'm your mother." And I didn't know what she was talking about. And so those are the kinds of things that very clearly have been done. So we would adopt our children in a non-official way. We didn't go downtown, take out paperwork, and do all of that. They would take you, raise the kids. Everybody in the community would support, do things. Most of the times it was built around a very strong community, a church community, sometimes a school community. And so that's where that whole concept about it takes a village to bring up a child, that's where that comes from, out of West Africa. And so as you continue to think about that, I'm not going to go too much deeper into this, but as you think about it, you can understand a little bit how that might have affected things. You get sick. The community would come together and heal you. People would start bringing you all kind of remedies and doing stuff in case when babies were born. The community came together and sometimes birthed that baby into existence. Because a lot of times these people were fearful to send their children, pregnant mothers, to hospitals because they were being killed. I think there's a strong evidence that did take place. And again, that's not our subject today, but you need to think about it. So again, the family was responsible for the children. The neighborhood was responsible for everybody's child. Children act up, everybody stepped in the picture. And children would care for their parents right on up through old age. Nobody went into nursing homes. Children were cared for at home by everybody. There were things like crimes that could be committed. The community would come together sometimes to help pay the legal cost if things were done or somebody went to jail or something happened in that fact. The community would come together and do that. And so this kinship that I'm talking about is really the way to begin to look at healing the black community rather than looking at the pathological things that take place. The existence, for instance, of different cultural values and customs and taboos among various ethnic groups requires sometimes an understanding of why individuals, and now we make a lot of jokes sometimes and we kid about certain ethnic groups that they do things. I know there's a big thing about Mexican families will stay 15 in a house. They're in a two-bedroom house and about 15, 20 people living there. Well, that is a custom that took place, and it was not based totally out of poverty, but it was a custom that was put in place where the family did stay together. They did protect each other. They were very strong about what children did and what they didn't do. And so that was a part of that culture. You'll see that in other. They'll live together, 10, 15, and they'll share the cost. They'll share the food. They'd share the cleaning of the house, share the caring for them. We did that. But those of you who may not have had a chance to read this or may have read it, there was a book by a Nigerian writer named Chinua Achebe. He wrote a book called Things Fall Apart. But what he did is that he presents and paints a wonderful picture of traditional African life prior to slavery. And then he shows the breakup of that family as the transatlantic slave ship system begins to come in place. But it's a wonderful, wonderful idea, a wonderful book to read to look at how they do things. How the village took care of each other, how they handled food, and what is it that they did, and the way that they cooked, the village cooked. The whole idea, for instance, in the Christian church, is most churches down south have a activity once a year called homecoming. And homecoming normally was in the fall. Well, that is because in the years of the antebellum period and in the years of segregation, all of the families in the community would come together with potluck dinners and food that Somebody cooked. Somebody would cook the sweet potatoes. Somebody would fry the chicken. Somebody would make the bread. And they'd all bring it together in sort of like a family homecoming ceremony. I remember those coming up in the 40s and the 50s. I remember homecomings at our church. That was the best time of the year. Lord have mercy. The food, the cakes, the fried chicken, sweet potato pies. And you could smell it all downstairs that day, that Sunday. That church would be jam-packed. It's homecoming. People would come to church on homecoming more than they ever would. That came out of West Africa. That's where it started. And that was it. Now, one last thing, and then I'm going to kind of go over to our audience a little bit. Let's talk, see what you think about this whole way of resurrecting the black family and what we can use. Now, I want you to make sure you don't think that I'm saying we overlook some of the travails of black family life. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying when we start looking at solutions, let's look at the solutions from the strengths of the black family as opposed to their pathology. So one of the other things that you would obviously study is the system of marriages, particularly in West Africa. And even though it's totally a different culture than what we have here in America, it's some stuff there that's extremely important. And there are some things that I remember carrying over to the point that when I was coming up as a young man and we started dating, a lot of these ideas and systems were in place. Many of the marriages in traditional West Africa were intricately related, believe it or not, to kinship. Marriage was governed by a variety of rules. Some of these rules were what's called exogamous, which means marrying outside of the group, outside of the clan. That was not allowed to do, which means outside of that family line. Yeah. And others were things like endogamous, marriage inside the family line. That becomes a question. McCall advances the a researcher by the name of McCall advanced the idea that marriages began along with the whole idea of families coming together and discussing who the daughter would marry. Marriages between cross cousins, children of the marriages of a brother and sister, were the more preferred arrangements. Whereas a marriage between parallel cousins, children of the marriages of two brothers or two sisters, would be forbidden. But these marriages were based on a practice that was designed to create alliances between two lineages of families. And so a lot of times we've had a talk of a cousin liking another cousin. That was fine in West African tradition, provided that arrangement was determined ahead of time. Marriages in West Africa were arranged relatively early in the life of an adult. Sometimes partners were earmarked in childhood for the purpose of solidifying social relationships. And then researchers have understood that marriage in the West African scene was traditionally recognized point of entry into family formation and even business in businesses. It was indeed a complex affair now because everything had to be understood. So, for example, identification of a bride or a groom, consolidation, may require a payment. Or some kind of a monetary effort to show that you were capable of taking care of a wife. And now, obviously, that can't happen today, but at least you can see the order. It was just more out of not liking somebody or marrying somebody because they were pretty, they thought they had money, those kinds of things. That these were things that they were taking in consideration that were extremely, extremely important. Even into the polygamy situation and how that used to work in some areas, a lot of it was not done out of a man having the desire to just have a whole lot of women. That was not the case. The case was based on, a lot of times, the economy of that society, the economy of that village. And those strong agricultural economies needed a lot of children, just like eventually after the transatlantic slave trade came to America, people began to have large families so they could work the farms. So you might have Aunt Susie got 20 kids, and those 20 kids are out picking cotton and tobacco. And this was done for the sake of commerce. And so polygamy came out of a commercial kind of approach. And again, these are just ways that sociologists and so forth have looked at studying these things and understanding how they've been done. But nevertheless, though, the bottom line, I think, on all of this is that the study of the African-American family's strengths is important for researchers, for theorists, for counselors, and education. Individuals that are interested in understanding and enhancing the ethnic identity of African-American families can become more aware of these strengths of black families as a critical element in working with them. So by understanding, and understand this very clearly, by understanding and enhancing the ethnic identity of African-Americans and increasing the awareness of their strengths, black families will be more capable of meeting the challenges of a changing society. Very recently, back in the late 90s, or right at the turn of the century, the federal government, the Department of, it was all a part of Health and Human Services, but there was another branch of that strictly dealt with families, and they were giving out grants and monies to community organizations to work with families. They had something called Best Marriages, they were funding people to begin to practice different principles in terms of marriage because of the fact that it had a lot of weight, you know, on, as everybody has come to know, on other areas of life. And so even the welfare system, that's where that whole study was done on the black family as an attempt to deal with the welfare issue. And then the more recent one in the 2000 was the same thing with parents, mothers having to be on what's called W-2. And they passed legislation to support W-2. And there's a long history of that, studies like that. And then let's not forget the eugenics movement and what they did in order to control and put their hands on things in terms of the African-American life. That was a horrible situation. And then if a lot of that didn't work, there are other forms of chemical warfare that were used, such as the Tuskegee experiment and others, to control the numbers and populations. And I'm sure, and I don't want to get into this tonight, but I can promise you there are a lot of folk that have some ideas that of what COVID might be and the possibility that it may be something. Now, I'm not saying, because I don't know, I haven't done the research. So, but there are some things that I've read by folk that feel that that's more to it than just a germ going wild. There's more, a lot to behind that. So with that, my brothers and sisters, I think we want to make sure that we do more for the black family. We want to put more things in focus. We want to create situations and opportunities where community leaders and politicians will make decisions and policies, that the public policy of focus on black families is a lot stronger than it has been. And it's not. Most of the time, like I said, it focuses on the pathological issues. It focuses on teen pregnancy and all of that. And all of those things exist. But they existed in the 50s and 40s, too. Teen pregnancy didn't just start. That's been going on for a while. But the community, the family knew how to handle that. They knew how to keep that moving. Fathers running from their kids just didn't start back in the 70s and 80s. But there was another way it was coach, and it was done by the community, not by the government. And that's where we've got to get back to doing some of that. So with that, I'm going to see what our audience has to say about this whole situation, because we've got to resurrect the black family. And we've got to find ways to not only just heal the trauma that we've gone through, but we've got to see about putting systems in place that can begin to make a difference and to sort of to move forward. So with that, I'm going to go, and then I'm going to take about two or three right now, and then I'm going to go back and come to the top of the hour, and then come back on again. Let me go to Brother Herbie White. How you doing tonight, Brother Herbie? Brother White? Okay, I thought I might have hit the wrong button. He was on. I'll come back. Pastor Lewis, you deal with black families all the time. Do you see us being able to approach that from looking at its strengths as opposed to its weaknesses? Brother Greg Lewis, you might have your phone on mute, so if you want to give you a minute to do that. Pastor Lewis, I see you there. Your phone might be on mute. Pastor Lewis? Okay, all right. We'll come back. If you do hear me, your phone might have been on mute and I just couldn't hear you. Dr. Bridges, is that you? Dr. Bridges? 641-0288. 919-641. Okay. Again, it might be on mute again as well. Brother Timothy, what you think?
Oh, Dr. Rogers, you know, you're talking about the good thing in the black family that we do pick up from one another.
Right.
Well, I guess the steps we learn to survive and go through it all and build it. It's amazing what we do with nothing. Okay. I mean, you know, it came out of institutionalized slavery, man, with nothing.
Right.
And we've gone far. I mean, you know, not reading, not writing, lost out of education, not eating the right type of foods, not fully knowing all your family and who they are. That's pretty good to survive in this place.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, like, look at it like, wow, like the Humpty Dumpty piece. but you know, somehow the it's crazy glue in some parts of the plate and the top, the middle, and we put it together, man. Listen to me. It ain't perfect, but it's better than a whole lot in America, man.
Yep.
It ain't perfect. It's better than a whole lot of people. Other places.
Right. I agree. My first classroom was not at the public school. It was on my back porch, my parents' back porch, sitting out there having to read a book. And I was told, don't come back in the house till I finish.
Right.
You might think that's bad parenting, but it helped me learn how to read a book.
Right.
I had to come back and tell what I read. But anyway, you're right. I appreciate it. I know the nation has a very strong program on family and marriages and rules and like that. I think that's very key.
Also, we had a big dysfunction, too.
Right.
We had the formula to what got us to where we're at in the nation, but
right.
we were really like anything else. Unprepared. Didn't know what we were doing and trying to get further. And just, I think he did a great job. Went to the second grade, thought a man went to eighth grade.
Right.
People who are in prison called him a reformer. He was bigger than a reformer.
Right. He was.
Intellectuals, you know, his program really came from prison. He had one of the first prison ministries. It came big in the industry, in the industry of economic sociology. It went from the prison to the intellectuals, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know? This is the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how you would come across a brother who you thought you knew something, and he knew the message teacher. He knew everything. You said, "Why? How you find that out? You want to go with him to find out how he got the information."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Right.
He gave the lowness and the man in the mud something to pull himself up. That's it. He gave the man in the mud something.
Right. Right.
The man in the mud.
Okay, well, Brother Timothy, I really appreciate that. I'm going to move over here to the next person. Sister Yan, I know you and I have talked in depth about black family work and what has to happen in black family. Can you see an agenda that maybe starts focusing on not what's wrong, but what's good, the strength of the black family? What do you think about that idea?
First of all, greetings. It's been a minute. Peace and love to everybody.
Same to you.
How you doing, Doc?
Doing great. Doing great.
Good. Now, what was your specific question?
Well, the question is, our discussion has been that we need to approach.
I've been listening. I have been listening.
Okay. Well, that's the question.
Right.
What do you think?
I thought you asked me something directly about. What did you say about solution rather than?
I'm saying, what
problem?
Do you think about the solution of working to resolve some of the issues of the black family by looking at its strengths?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, this is what I think, because I have very definite, I'll say, understanding of our situation from so much and so much interaction with our people and working with our people, and you know, just from all across the diaspora, you know, from those that are in the U.S. But anyway. I have to start with Garvey, because every time we talk about the family, the black family,
mm-hmm.
I think about Garvey saying that we would drink the poison of Eurocentric culture and we will die from the effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we were brought here, when we came here, we didn't have any of those issues of, you know, division within the family and all the stuff we see now. We didn't have that. What we had was what you were talking about earlier. You know, we're going to go see, my mother used to say, we got to go see about Aunt so-and-so. And we were saying, who's Aunt? You know, and she meant aunt.
Mm-hmm.
But they were from the South.
Mm-hmm.
We got to go see how Aunt so-and-so is doing. We got to go see Uncle so-and-so. And we go see all these older people. And, you know, as young people, we didn't know them. But my mother and my parents, my father also, they kept the tradition of the extended family and the concern and care going.
Right.
And so I grew up with that, and I see that as normal. But I will tell you that my this generation that exists now, these young adults, has been lost to most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the books that you were talking about, you know, are great. As I listened to the titles and what they were about. But what I would add to that is that all we have to do is go in the country where black folk haven't been as whitewashed and brainwashed with white culture,
mm-hmm.
and watch what they do. They still value and work at keeping extended family together. So we don't have to look far to find it. It does still exist. It existed in my family when I was growing up. We took in, there was a sister that had some addiction issues, and she had four children. My family just took them in.
Right, that's right.
She said, "Well, you take my children, I got to go get myself together." We took them in. There was no question about that.
That's right.
And at the time, there were no Christians in my family. We were a bunch of hoodlums. You know, we're not hoodlums. That's kind of a joke, but we were street fighters, and you know, we were, you know, our parents worked and everything, but we were kind of hood.
Right. Right.
But we still kept the tradition going.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we don't have to look far. We don't have to do a lot of reading. We just have to look at what our people are still doing. The Gullah Geechee area in South Carolina.
Oh, yeah, that's a good example. Yeah,
example. they're keeping that village. You know, they're working hard. They're fighting against a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know, of this invasive Eurocentric culture. But there are people that are still practicing. go to any African area, I'm sorry, any area where black folk are practicing African spirituality,
right,
where there's a strong Ifa community,
right,
you know,
it is,
or
yeah,
or in Cuba, you know, with I think they're practicing Lukumi,
mm-hmm,
or even Puerto Rico, you know, where they're practicing Santeria, and like you said, Mexican communities.
Right.
If you go to Native, Red, Black communities, there are people who are fighting to keep their traditions of extended family going. The only ones that didn't have that tradition of extended family and value and culture was the Europeans.
Right, because they wanted to be isolated. Yeah, that's right.
Right, and that rugged individualism. And I'm, you know what, I don't need to say this, but I'm going to say it. I'm not trying to beat up on Europeans anymore. Because they're sick.
Yeah.
And we're sick because they're sick. And so we've got to get, you know how I am about healing. We've got to heal before we can restore, you know, who we are. So I wanted to quote Marimba Ani.
Okay.
Because I saw when I saw your advertisement for the show, and I said, oh, I got to call in on this. Because you know I've been dealing with some heavy
stuff. I know
stuff.
Families for a long time, yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah. But Marimba Ani said, a people without a culture is like a tree without roots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if that's an original or not, but it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
Once we started losing our culture of extended family, that's when we started just breaking apart, and then colorism and, you know, resentments that people are not able to resolve, and all these other issues started settling in. And because we lost our culture, our council of elders, you know, our elders, our discipline, once we started losing all of that and letting our children just kind of run wherever, we lost our roots.
Right, we did.
So we have to have something that roots us to our culture. I also want to share something that I learned from a good friend that his name is Dr. Ogundiran from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And he was teaching me about African culture, and he said, the whole of West African and probably the whole of African culture is centered around keeping the extended family and the village together.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose of the family. That's what it's centered around. It's not centered around making money like the Euros. You know, it's not centered around fashion and all these other crazy external things. You know, it's centered around keeping everybody together, even, you know, if it means, and it does oftentimes, polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things you were talking about, marrying, you know, arranged marriages and whatnot. He taught me that all of those things that we may think is strange is set up to ensure the maintenance of the African village.
That's right.
So all these things are done with a very clear vision in mind so that we don't fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And just like that book said, you know, the brother, I remember the pronunciation, things fall apart.
We fell apart. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we lost the culture. So in terms of solution, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking we have to be hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what our ancestors did. They were hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
They had us, you know, in Africa, you know, or wherever else, even, you know, here with the indigenous folk or wherever, you know, African descendants or people of African descent were, the elders taught the young.
Right, exactly.
Now, if the young didn't listen, they had some heavy discipline. You don't get away with just doing any old thing that you want to do.
Right.
So there has to be a hands-on approach, and before I forget this, because I don't want to talk too long, I gotta share this with you, Doc. I was talking with a young brother from Ghana, and a young adult, you know, well-educated, and you know, and whatnot. And he said, you know, what every African has told me, whether it's a Ghanaian, Togolese, Nigerian, doesn't matter where they're from, and I know several. They say that this culture is insane to them.
Mm-hmm.
They come here with one idea, and they see this culture, and they say, this is insanity. And so the young man told me that a lot of Africans that are here now are sending their children back to Africa. They send him, they want them right. to get the education and the other things, but they're sending them back to Africa.
They're smart.
He said they're sending them back to Africa because when they come here, they lose their discipline. Yes. They lose the respect that they had gotten from African culture. And when they go back to Africa, the elders have a hard time dealing with them because they're disrespectful. Mm-hmm. They're literally brainwashed once they get here.
Right.
And so that's pretty deep.
It is very deep. Very
that's
deep.
Pretty deep. And he said when that happens, it brings chaos. Listen to this. It brings chaos and disorder to the community. And he said, and then it becomes a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that definitely
so
does add to this discussion tremendously, because you're right. That's exactly what, and I don't blame him. I would send him back too.
Yet many Senegalese, so many professionals are telling me they're sending their children back because their children are getting messed up from being in America.
Right.
With all their education, they're mm-hmm. getting messed up.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I'll come back to you in a little while. We are going to take a break and then come back, and I want to hear from some folk. I was trying to get Pastor Lewis and I think it was Dr. Bridges on. I couldn't get them to answer. I couldn't get Brother Harry White to answer. So anyway, we'll try to come back. If you hear me, unmute your mics, and then we'll come back on and finish this, look at this discussion further about the black family. So let's take a quick break. We're talking today about May the Circle Be Unbroken, the resurrection of the black family in America.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Time for an awakening media lineup. All about times or Eastern Standard. On Mondays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspective with host Brother Oshie. On Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. On Monday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central with hosts Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone. On Monday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m., on the first and third Mondays of each month, Conversation Reparations. Conversation Reparations. On Tuesday evening, from 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. On Fridays, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. From 8 to 10 p.m., on Friday evenings, time for an awakening with host Brother Elliot Booker and his co-host Brother Richard. On Saturdays, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday evening, the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with host Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. And on Sunday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and his co-host Brother Richard. These are our lineup times. We thank you for your patronage, and please, by all means, check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All right, we are back, sisters and brothers. We're here tonight talking about May the Circle Be Unbroken, Resurrection of the Black Family. The little piece you heard during the break there was by Mississippi John Hurt, called May the Circle Be Unbroken, one of the old blues singers of Mississippi. He was doing that. The whole terminology of Let the Circle Be Unbroken is not necessarily an African perspective, but it does speak to families and the belief system in the thereafter. And the fact that we always want to hold on to our family. We want to be able to hold hands together and be together. And sometimes that circle will get broken. And so in the resurrection, where life supposedly based on whatever indoctrination you have, and we meet again, we want to be able to hold hands and make that strong circle. And that's where that concept comes from. And I remember there were games that we used to play as kids that betrayed that. There was a thing about you would form a circle and and there would be people that would be in the middle, and you would try to break it. You would try to break that circle if you could. And then I'm not sure, I forgot what happened after that, but it was an interesting game. So the point is, there's always been a focus to teach us the necessity of the unity of the family. And a lot of those times in the South, we really found those large communities and families that came together, even in the midst of segregation and hardcore racism. Black families stuck together. And so when we start looking at Black Wall Street, Tulsa, down in Rosewood, Florida, those were strong community, family, extended family kinds of environments. And the great Zora Neale Hurston wrote about a lot of that. And she did that in her books because she was an anthropologist. She studied anthropology. And she did that. So Eyes Were Watching God, pieces like that, Mule Bone, and some of the other works that she wrote were embracing those family networks. And there were problems. You know, not all of them weren't, you know, free. There were problems. But bottom line, it was still family networks. Ralph Ellison wrote it in The Invisible Man, that strong family bond that we talk about. And then that whole thing we get into sometimes about women when they are forced to have to raise their children without a male in the house, that they can't do it. You need to rethink that one, because these sisters can do it. They may not want to do it, or don't think they should have to do it, but a strong mother can do that, and she can do it well. So my suggestion would be we rethink that. Pastor Lewis, are you there? I was trying to reach you before and couldn't get you. I know in your work as a minister, the whole Black church is based on Black family. And by the way, before I go to it, I just want to thank you again, those of you who were online, we weren't online before. I want to thank you for answering that call for last Sunday with Dr. Bruce Bridges. Went over to the First Baptist Church of Holly Springs and spoke on the Black church. Had a wonderful turnout of our family members. and they came, and he did a magnificent job of talking about that role the Black church played. And it really is a family kind of role. And so he talked about that and the history of where all of that came from. And you can go back and listen to that by going to the First Baptist Church of Holly Springs website, Facebook website, and play that program again. But I really appreciate all of you. Very well done. You responded to that. And also, just to kind of add to that, Reverend Michael Rogers, who is the one that invited Dr. Bridges, and whose anniversary was, also does a program called Gospel Gold. It comes on Monday evenings at 8 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock Eastern, and he does not just gospel music playing. It's not about that. It's about the history and the connection that it had to our people, and a lot of it is centered around strong family unions. Yesterday, he did one on the Staples singers, Roebuck Staples, Pop Staples, and how he brought his family together to make music and make money and feed the family. And they did it for many, 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 many years, and looking at gospel music that way. So anyway, I just wanted to add that. So Pastor Lewis, how do you see this resurrecting our Black family? Pastor Lewis, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, there's a lot of noise in your background. I'm not sure what that is.
I don't think it's my background. Is it my background? Because I'm in a room where it's quiet, Dr. Rogers.
Okay, all right, well, good. I keep hearing something back there because your thing lights up when I hear it. But anyway, never mind. What do you think about resurrecting the Black family by looking at some of the strengths as opposed to their weaknesses?
You know, Dr. Rogers, I just think that, you know, we have to be aware of how powerful the Black family is, and how we have to understand the basis of any nation's power is the strength of families. And as, you know, black people in America, it's almost like a nation. You know, we have to make certain that...
No, I'm just saying, you're right about it. It's a nation. You're right.
Yeah. So we have to make sure that our young folks understand how powerful it is that we stick together and learn how to help each other. And the beginning of all of that is through the family. You know, Dr. Amos Wilson, in his book, Blueprint to Black Power, you know, he talks about the family and how the basis of every nation's power, the beginning of all of it, is the family. And that's why people spend so much time trying to make sure that men aren't in the homes. And you're right, man, I was raised by a strong mother.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it would have been a little bit different if my dad had been there, because, you know, I was a real boy. You know, I got in a lot of trouble. And, you know, she wasn't hip to everything, Dr. Rogers. But my dad, you know, when he did come around, he kind of knew when I was kind of, you know, joshing him, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we are rebuilding ourselves right now. I don't know. I just see a bright future for us here in America.
Right.
Because I think things are getting better, and we have to continue as a grandfather. I have to continue to instill in my grandson that he has to take real serious the importance of our families, and that he needs to look out for his mom and the rest of his relatives and family members. And I think that's what we have to do, Dr. Rogers. Let folks understand and know our history, where we come from,
right,
how powerful we really are as people, how we did, you know, create the sciences and mathematics and all those things that, you know, have been taken, you know, by someone else to be, you know, something that they have brought to this world. We have to let people know that we're the folks who did all those things, so we can recalibrate.
Right.
And that's what's going on. We still have strong young people. Now, we got strong young geniuses, but it just seems like the school systems, once they get in them, you know, they seem to go backwards, Dr. Rogers. I don't know what that's all about, but, you know, in Milwaukee, we have a real problem with failing students in our Milwaukee public schools. And we're like 80% of the student body here. So, you know, we just have to continue to grow ourselves understanding who we are. And because the knowledge, the intellect is there. You know, just because a person's not educated doesn't mean he doesn't have intellect. It just means he hadn't gone to school and been educated to the fact that we have to deal with this system. And now, you know, I think that the time is now that we understand who we are, so we can recalibrate. I just think that's where we are right now.
Beautiful.
It's the old Willie Lynch syndrome, you know.
Okay.
It's going to reverberate with us forever if we don't do something about it quickly. So
beautiful.
That's what I think.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Appreciate that. Let's go over to Washington, D.C., area code 301-860. Any questions or thoughts you might have on the black family?
This is Wahida calling in.
Yes, how you doing,
and,
sister?
I'm fine, and you?
Okay.
Okay, peace and blessings to everyone.
Thank you.
A lot of things that people have said remind me of how important the black family is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying in Islam that says, heaven is at the feet of the mother.
Mm.
And the mother is the person who first teaches the child. And so, you know, everything, and she's a part of the family.
Right.
The fact that people are sending their children back to Africa or back to anywhere that was home is prevalent throughout the country with a lot of immigrants. I worked as a ESL teacher, English as a second language, and I taught people from students from all over the world.
Mm.
And I've seen children who are from Arab backgrounds, from Egypt or from Morocco. And when it's not unusual in the Islamic community of immigrants that they send their children back when they're 12 or 13 years old, when they start to act like Americans.
Right.
And they send them back home. They send them back, you know, when they finish high school and they think they want to act like, you know, Americans. They, you know, they could be 20 years old and daddy will send you back. Okay. Why? Because you have that strong background in Africa that will straighten you out.
Exactly.
And will help you because,
exactly.
I've seen it. I taught immigrant students for about 25 years.
Right.
From all over, and I've seen the parents send them back when they get out of control. And part of the problem is, and we're supposed to be talking about solutions, but the children want to imitate what they see in America, whether it's good or bad. And they want to fit into the American society.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that Western mentality is detrimental to all families, whether you're from El Salvador or you're from South Africa. When you start to act like the American children, then you start to run into problems.
That's true.
So, and I grew up in a household where my mother was from Tennessee, my father was from Maryland, and the black family was extended in our house.
Yes, indeed.
Anybody that came from Tennessee and didn't have a place to stay and needed somewhere to go before they could get on their feet came to my house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
So
right.
I was used to that. And so I had many aunties.
And you ate good, too. You didn't starve. You ate good.
I don't know what it means to be hungry.
I don't know either. I didn't know what that was.
Never hungry, never outdoors, always had shoes. I didn't know I was poor until I went to college,
mm-hmm.
and so many people had so much more stuff than I did.
Right.
And I said, wow, you know, we must have grew up kind of poor.
Right.
We never had a car, but I always had food.
That's right.
You know.
That's the deal. I don't remember ever being hungry.
I had those things that were necessary for survival. And I thank God that my parents taught me what was important.
Right.
And so I've always had food, clothing, and shelter. Because that's
go.
What you needed.
There you go.
Okay, so, right. But yeah, we got to get back to those basic things.
You're right.
We got to get back to, you know, Uncle Frank and Aunt Lucy.
Right.
Who was no blood kin, but they were family.
They were family.
And we took care of each other.
Sure did.
We don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've turned to the culture of me, I. And, you know, I live in this big house by myself and won't let anybody in. When, you know, I can remember when a whole family lived in one of our bedrooms. Whole family
right.
was in there because they had come up from the South, and they needed to get on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to have somewhere to go. And so we had many people come through our doors.
Right.
And my mother was very well respected. And I had a mother and father that I grew up with. So, you know, I had both of them in the family.
Right.
And in the house at the same time.
Right.
And Mama was strong. We got strong black women. And we have to remember, doing slavery when we took care of somebody else's child because, you know, they were sold over this way. There was no such thing that a black woman couldn't raise a child.
That's right.
Male or female. So that idea that, you know, I can't do this. Yeah, you can.
Yes, you can.
You just have to be strong enough to do it.
Right.
And we have to get back to our roots and know who we are. And know that we can do whatever is necessary to survive, and not only survive but to thrive.
Right.
And we did that. And like you said, our history shows us.
That's right.
Our history shows us. You know, I look at people who had college degrees or were writing books. Phyllis Wheatley wrote the first book in America that a woman wrote, and that was what. 18-something, 17-something?
Yeah,
so you mean to tell me
yep.
that with all of the opportunity that we have, I said, with all the libraries we have, nobody has an excuse about being ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuses
yep.
anymore. If people could do that 200 years ago, educate themselves and, you know, do the things that they did, we have no excuse today.
Right.
We just need to be serious about life
and
do what's necessary.
All right. All right. Thank you so much, my sister. I did get your comments about the service. I saw that. I passed it on.
Oh, okay.
Passed it on to Pastor Rogers. Let him know that you had commented. So, again, thank you for listening. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank
all
you.
Right. Thank you so much. And what the sister was saying is so right, because I look today at a lot of these teen girls, young girls that are getting pregnant, 16, 15-year-olds, it's usually some mercenary angel, some angel of mercy that steps in and helps, if not adopt or not take the family. And that adoption system, foster care system, we know is ugly and it doesn't work. So there'll be people that will, rather than see that happen, will still date that. So there are folk out there that are still doing that. I don't have numbers, I don't have the study or the quantitative data to support that up, but I know it just from living in life and living in my community. I know that, and family. I know what that means. I had to raise my granddaughter because her mom was young, and that's just the way we did it. Didn't worry about it, didn't fuss about it, didn't try to go down and get a check to help with it. That wasn't the deal, and this was 70, this was 80s, and others I know that did the same thing. You're not going to see that baby out there doing, trying to be raised by a 17-year-old, 16-year-old. No, come on. But anyway, that's it. We got to get back to that that attitude again. Dr. Bridges, is that you?
I was here before.
All
can
right,
you hear
man.
Me now?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you before. I tried to call on you. Listen, you did a wonderful job.
Yeah, I know you did. I heard you.
Yeah.
I heard you, and I was talking, but you couldn't hear me.
You probably had your phone muted. Yeah, but you did a wonderful job last Sunday. Thank you so much. Some of your the listeners from last Sunday are online here now, and I really thank you for plugging the Black Reality Think Tank at your sermon. And that was a sermon you did. And I'm not laughing at you, Bruce. You know what I mean? But you did a good job, though. You did that. You really did excellent. And I really appreciate Pastor Rogers.
I just wish that.
So anyway, what you think about this family thing, Dr. Bruce?
Oh, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I can kind of tie it into the history of the Black Church also, which I had really planned to talk about. But as you know, Reverend Rogers only gave me a certain amount of time, and he couldn't do it all. But since you mentioned churches, history of the Black Church and families, there are several churches in the South, and I know of about five I can think of right now in this Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina area, where whole families are tenants in the church. It's almost like a family church. You know what I'm talking about.
Exactly right.
Yeah, and I can think of some, and some of the churches are named for the families. Like I know a church called Lipscomb Memorial Church out in Rouge Mountain, North Carolina. Most of the people in that church are Lipscombs.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the plantation, well, first of all, the Europeans wanted to divide us when we first came over here from the very beginning. On the auction blocks, and even after the auction blocks, as you well know, they would always take the mother, send the mother to one plantation, take the father, send him to another plantation. The children would go to another plantation, and it goes on and on and on. And so then there was a reason for that. And the reason was what you've been talking about already, to break those bonds of kinship.
Right.
That's why that was done. They wanted to break those bonds of kinship. Your mother's gone, your father's gone, you here being raised by some other people that you don't know. So what we did was we went from what may have come over onto to the plantations of the South as nuclear families. Then those nuclear families became extended families.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See, because when the nuclear family was broken up and sent off into several different plantations, one writer said, every time your plantation owner's name changed, so did your name change. You were gone to, you might have been in the Johnson Plantation this morning. In the afternoon, you might become a member of the Jackson Plantation,
right,
depending on who your slave master was. So what all that did in terms of the division and the breakup of the family and the changing of the names, it made us, as Sister Beniswa said, it made us rootless, and our roots were not connected to anything. We were just kind of fly by night. We had nothing to connect to, nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to even be here today as human beings and to have some sense of survival, it shows how great a people we are, because our roots were continuously and consistently cut off. Every time we came to a plantation, they would always divide that family. So then we developed we went from the nuclear family to the
right.
Extended family, and the extended family might not necessarily be your own blood. And mm-hmm. I've heard Stokely Carmichael say many times that when we start talking about brothers and sisters, people are not brothers and sisters merely because of the sake of blood, but it is mentality more than it is biology mm-hmm. that makes men and women brothers and sisters. You
That's
and I
right.
could be more brothers and sisters than, say, maybe you and one of your blood brothers and sisters because of the way that we think.
That's right. That's right.
So this is what we have to understand. We have to understand that it has to be taken a little further than just your mother and your father and your siblings and your little nuclear family, but it extends much further than that. And that's what European people don't want us to understand, because as we begin to make those connections from one family member to another family member and begin to hook it up, then what you have is what? Organization.
That's right.
You begin to organize people, organize families, organize churches, as a matter of fact.
That's
and
right.
Organization is one thing that Europeans do not want us to have. And so that's kind of the point that I wanted to make. And I want to thank all those people, too, who listened on Sunday and hope they did get something out of the lecture on Sunday.
Well, it was down there. And you're right so much. That's why we're doing this discussion tonight, because I'm hoping that we can spark some energy somewhere. And like I say, so as we do our planning, as we do our get-togethers, let's don't stop having our picnics, family reunions. Let's don't do that. Let's make sure we use I had this family, the large family, they still do Zoom. They do Zoom gatherings. So you got to use what we got.
Mm-hmm. And that's another feather in the hat of the black church again, too, when we're talking about things that have come out of the black church. That's why, as I said, Sunday, you can't put the black church down.
Right.
The black church was able to, like you said, they'd have those homecomings.
Yep.
Not only would they have homecomings, but they'd have homecomings, but they'd also have revivals every day of the week. All the families get together and go to the revival services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they also had vacation Bible schools, where we studied the Bible
That's right.
in the morning.
That's right.
after we finished that, we played baseball, we played horseshoes, you see?
Right.
And all those activities were designed to be something that would cement, or something that would stick and hold the black family together. And that's what that was. And it wouldn't always be the people with the same last name as yours, or people who
That's right,
with the same blood as yours. As a matter of fact, most of the time it wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It wouldn't. Yep, exactly right.
So the black church, that's another tribute that we have to make to for the black family.
Yes, exactly.
I mean for the black church. We have to give credit to the black church for that, like we talked about on Sunday.
Right.
But there's so much that you just can't say it all.
And we're leaving, by leaving the black church out. You're right. I agree with you, Dr. Bridges. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, there's some churches that do what's called Family and Friends Day. And
that's right.
They all dress up in African garment and their kente, and they come to church and have service. And go ahead. These are a must-do activities. Regardless of what you think about the black church and all of this thing, these are things that do healing. This is how a part of the healing process, you know, this is that, you know, it may be minute, but it's a way to do that. The community, Kwanzaa, is a healing ceremony. We get a chance to come together and meet your friends and talk. Here in Milwaukee, now, Pastor Lewis, you can tell about this. We used to have a beautiful family gathering called African World Festival. And all the brothers and sisters would get together here in Milwaukee. That's where I haven't seen people in years. All year long, I'd get together at the end of, I think it was the 1st of August, on the first couple of weeks of August, and we had what they call African World Festival. They would bring entertainers, and they would have African gift shops and food, and just, oh, man, it was the greatest thing I've ever seen. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and I was about to say, and when you said that, too, you reminded me, too, when you were talking to Brother Timothy, when you go back to the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, he called it Islam, but really, a lot of stuff that was going on in the Nation of Islam, including the teaching by the ministers, wasn't a whole lot of Quran. It was mostly that Old Testament Bible, and even the culture and what was going on in the Nation of Islam in terms of the families and what people were doing. It's the same thing as the church. They might have said assalamu alaikum as opposed to saying good morning.
Right.
But it was the same thing.
Same thing.
Getting the chance to dress up, like I said, Sunday, and put on a suit tie, and the women dressing up. Same thing in the church.
Right.
Same thing.
Right.
Look,
I agree.
Every Sunday when I go to the mosque in number 34 in Durham, when the mosque was over, started at 2 o'clock, mosque was over about 3 or 4, they had dinner in the back, ready for you to sit down and eat dinner.
That's right.
Eat some brown rice and some Arabian style cabbage and chicken.
And some good old like bean pie.
it basically was a church by another name. I mean, I never thought about it till now. Yeah. But that's really what the Nation of Islam was.
It was. And, it really was. And I've often said, Minister Farrakhan ain't nothing but a Baptist preacher.
and you know another thing too is I'm gonna get off this subject, but you make me think about all this stuff was in New York they always had black Family Day. The Muslims would have Black Family Day. What they would do is have vendors and have music and dance, and people have art exhibits, and people walk around and listen to the jazz and look at what the vendors had to sell.
Right.
And then I went to Black Family Day in New York, I think it was about 1973, mm-hmm. and they flew Mr. Farrakhan in on a helicopter, and then he delivered the address and made an album called the Black Family Day album, and I still have a copy of that.
All right. I remember that.
So that's the same thing as the same thing in church was doing. Church, might they didn't call it Black Family Day.
Yeah, Black Family Day, Yep, that's right.
Can I say something here?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know you can. You're going to say it anyway.
Yes. I said greetings, Brother Bruce. I don't know if you heard me.
Oh, greetings. I didn't hear you.
Yeah. You know, what you all are saying is the same thing that we did in the Black Nationalist movement. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
In the East Brooklyn. You know, we did the same exact things. And what it makes me think of, what I said earlier about Garvey, you know, and what I said about African culture, wherever we are, it doesn't matter the religion. It really doesn't matter.
That's why
what matters is the culture. Mm-hmm. Wherever we are, we bring our culture. And our culture is communal, it's village.
That's it.
Not the individualist, all this other stuff that's non-African.
Right.
So, I really want to make this point. We're talking about solutions, what's good about. We have to snatch our young people out of the mindset, the Eurocentric mindset. I spoke to two young people recently, and they were activists, and they were telling me how hard it is to get young black activists away from this culture. Oh. And they the stuff that we're talking about now... Mm-hmm. Some of them say, oh, that's that old stuff. For them, it's old. It's, you know, now you got to do your own thing. And, you know, I got to have my own money and my own place. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult for us to rebuild if we don't snatch, or impossible, if we don't snatch our youth back. Because you got that whole Western media telling them that they need to be individualists.
Feeding their brains.
And millionaires.
Yeah.
They got to be millionaires in order to be successful.
Right.
And Africans are saying, no, your wealth is in each other. It's in Ubuntu. It's in the unity of black folk. That's where your wealth is.
Right. And Sister, but this is why you make a good point, too, when you mention... Garvey, because Garvey had the parades and the black nurses.
He sure did. That's why he did that.
And since we're talking about the church, let's take it on back to Father Divine.
Yep.
Father Divine would have those big dinners and Sweet Daddy Grace. They had dinner meetings, but they had dinner after the meeting and the restaurants and all that. But that was the black church.
See, that was the family.
Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad just took what he knew. From his background down in there in Georgia, in Sandersville, Georgia,
right.
And turned it around into Islam. But he did the same thing. Sweet Daddy Grace, Father Divine, they all did the same.
Exactly.
Communal ideas, communalism.
Right. Let me go over here. I hadn't heard from him for a while. Brother Marcus, how you doing tonight, my friend? I hadn't heard from you in a while. You okay?
Yes, good brother. I'm here.
Good.
Dr. Rodney.
Thank
I'm
you.
Here to the ground.
All right.
Just want to say one thing here. You know, you talk about the church, and I think the clarion call right now for the church is Exodus. And the church right now is the only group that have the numbers to do a mass Exodus.
Yeah.
And what Sister Bonisa said, a lot of young people looking to the motherland, they don't give up. But we haven't seen a mass movement, and that's why that's where the church is pivotal at this time.
Right.
A mass movement and an economic base.
Exactly.
Again, a number, just simple number. 50,000 people contributing 20 cents a day for 100 days, that's $1 million. Mm. Quick, fast, and a hurry. $1 million in 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
The church has the numbers to make it happen.
It does. It does.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
Real quickly, Brother Kwazi, how you doing tonight? I know you've been there. You got a big day coming up on Thursday. What you want to tell us what's going to happen on Thursday?
Yes. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be talking about human trafficking,
okay.
You know, with sex trafficking. Child sex trafficking, the whole works, and the disconnect and how we look at food over feelings, you know, that thought of us looking at
because a lot of our young girls have gotten reaped away. We don't know where they are.
Yeah, I know. I was just looking at, you know, over 50 girls in a short period of time out of New York, you know, missing. But the sad part about it is the police that are investigating this, and, you know, and a lot of these girls are missing, and when they do find them, they find the body parts of them.
Oh, yeah.
So we just have so many different things, but they're not getting a lot of attention to it. And because they're not getting attention, and then there's a high percentage
right.
of it being our black African kids. And so
give the audience your time that you're coming on and the name of the program itself, your production.
It's going to be Warriors Way Production. And this is going to be from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay.
On Thursday.
Okay.
And so what? The program is going to be continuing the fight, and so we're going to be talking about that in just so many numerous ways. It's not a fight that we started, but that we've been in it, we can finish it, and we're not stopping. We're going to keep going.
Okay.
And there's so many different ways that we can fight.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We got 1 minute left. Let me ask Brother Herbie White. I had called on him before, but Brother White, you didn't answer me. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here, Dr. Rogers. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Uh-huh. Any closing remarks?
Good evening, everybody on the show.
Good.
Yes. And the position that you was talking about, focusing on the strength of reggae other than the negativity, every black family in this country is operating under trauma and stress. So when we're dealing with the negativity is only the families that were not able to overcome the trauma that they were dealing with.
Right.
It became too much for them.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And they were not able to hold their family together, and family members got away. The youth got away.
Right. Well, I got to close you out. As we're at that time, I wanted to hear more of that. We'll be back and revisit this topic again. Again, thank you all so much.
Dr. Rogers.
It's 9 o'clock, but go right ahead.
Okay, about 10 seconds. That's all I want.
Okay.
But one problem, as I mentioned on Sunday, the reason young people are not there, the reason people like me are not there, even though we understand the importance of the black church, but the black preacher has to realize that cultural element has to be there. And you just can't talk about what happened 5,000 years ago in the Bible, but it has to be made relevant to the culture and heritage of African people. Liberation theology has to be the order of the day.
Oh, I like that. Ooh, I like that. Very good. We'll revisit that as a concept, too, again. But thank you all so much for being with us. Next week, we'll be right back here at 7 o'clock. And we thank you for your participation, and we love our family. We got a great family right here. And we appreciate all of you. Thank you, and have a great, great week.
Watching the ships roll in, then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, just sitting on the dock of the bay, waste of time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, it looked like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my and this loneliness won't leave me alone. This 2,000 miles I roam just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away.